Hi, I'm Ross, and this is a CS50 seminar that will take you from programming in C to programming in Python. Python is a scripting language. It's largely like C in syntax, though some of the technical details of how that syntax gets executed are slightly different. It is less powerful than C in some ways. It is less expressive for where exactly in your computer memory gets laid out, how it gets laid out, when it gets freed, and those sorts of things. It's more useful than C in some ways, because it's easier to program in. The language is, to some people, more intuitive. And really, the goal is for it to be faster to program and potentially slower to execute. Now, if you think about the amount of time you spent on your last problem set writing your code against the amount of time you spent on your last problem set executing your code, you'd imagine that a language which was twice as fast to write and twice as slow to execute might be an improvement over C in some ways. Certainly, when you're trying to write small programs to do little things, Python is a useful language of choice. And at the end of this seminar, I hope that you'll be able to make the choice in future projects about which language is correct to use. Not the idea that one language is more correct all the time. A few things about what the seminar is. This seminar is not intended to teach you Python from scratch. Python is very similar to C, and I'm assuming that you're a CS50 student or someone with a similar familiarity with C. If you're a CS50 student around problem set 6, so you've seen a lot of things in C, I'll give you the major differences and some of the things that make Python different and special and useful, but I'm not going to go over what a programming language is and how to write programs. However, this seminar will teach you to write Python programs if you're one of those few groups. Again, we'll look at how you would implement PSETs that should be 1 to 6 in Python and provide pointers to official documentation for future reference. The other thing that's important about how this talk is designed, this video will be online courtesy of CS50, so you shouldn't feel like you need to take notes. If you can always go back and look at it later as a reference. Additionally, the slides are available right now at this site, which should take you to a Google Doc. It's a slightly abridged version of what I'm showing on the screen. One careful caveat before we jump in. Python 3 is a different language from Python 2. They look a lot the same. There are very slight technical differences that will cause programs written in Python 2 not to be able to be executed in the Python 3 environment. The CS50 appliance comes with Python. By default, it uses Python 2. You can check this by typing in your command line python --version, which should output 2.7.6 on the current appliance. Try Python 3, which does work in the appliance, if Python defaults to 2.x.y, either on the appliance or on your own machines. You should replace Python 3 anytime in this talk that I write Python. If your machine's running 2 by default, type Python 3 in order to be able to actually follow along and execute these things. Additionally, I'll point you at official resources now. docs.python.org/3, careful that that's a 3 and not a 2, has useful references. Tutorial will take you through much of the same things that I'm doing now, except in text form. Reference is, well, useful as a reference for the language, and the standard library gives you some of the extensions with additional functionality. So, a very first Python program. On the left, we have standard C. On the right, we have Python. You might have recognized this problem. It's one of the first problem sets in CS50. And these solve it using the same solution. Now, the reason that we're looking at these side by side is so we can look at syntactic differences. One of the elephants in the room that you might have noticed right off the bat is that Python has no main function wrapping around the code. So in C, you write a bunch of files, you link them together, and the program starts executing at this thing called int main. In Python, you write a file, you execute the file, the program starts executing at the top of the file. So it's going to start at the top of the file and go down until it finds something else. If it finds a function definition, it won't actually execute that code, it'll simply define the function. But here, when the first line of the program is n equals 10, the first thing that this program will do is take this value of 10 and set it into a variable called n. Speaking of that line, one of the other things this means that C programs, you'll write them, you'll make them, which will invoke some clang commands, and then you'll run a resulting executable. Python programs, you run the text file. This mario.py might be this file that I just showed you. You'll run that file and you'll execute, and the contents of it will be executed by the Python interpreter. You can do this in your IDE. So if I have a hello file, which simply has this content. This is actually Python 2, not Python 3, so don't worry about the syntax for now. But I'll run Python on hello.py, and it runs. Another way that I can use Python that I won't deal with so much in this talk is if I just type Python, it drops me into an environment where I can feed it Python line by line. So here, if I type in print space hello world, type enter, it'll spit me that back the results of that like individual line immediately. This might be useful. In this talk, I'll do things on slides, and so you'll be able to follow along either in here or by writing actual files and then executing them. But going back to this code, another thing that you might have noticed, well, there's two things that you might notice about these blocks. The first, rather more mundane, is that the Python has no trailing semicolon. Semicolons are optional everywhere and harmless everywhere. You can add them. It might make people who write Python for a living snicker at you behind your back because they're not necessary. They're often a sign of being held over from C. The designers of the language feel that it is more clear this way and that it's not necessary to declare every time you end a line. Another strange thing about this N is it doesn't have a type attached. One of the magic pieces of Python, I'm going to call it magic, but there are very technical reasons why it works. One of the magic pieces of Python is that variables can expand or shrink to contain whatever data types you would want them to. So this is a 10. If later down I assigned to this n 0.5, it would take that 0.5. No matter that it's an int here and a float there, anything that uses this n will more or less be able to chug along if it gets either of those, unless there's some very real reason why it can't use the data type that n currently has, at which point it'll get wedged and throw an error and those sorts of things. But here, Python doesn't really care what it is that I'm going to stick in this n. It's like, oh, you want this thing? It's sticking in an n? Yeah, it's kind of a thing. I'll stick it in the n. It'll be a problem later on if somebody who wants to use that n can't handle it. This is one of the major differences between Python and C that makes it easy to write very large C programs, makes it easier to write very small Python programs. The for syntax is not very different in what it does. It's slightly different in how it's expressed. So this is a very what is called Pythonic way of writing it. For row in range n. So this is the range of numbers from 0 to n, inclusive on the bottom and exclusive on the top. So it's from 0 to n minus 1, which is exactly what the C code is doing, except it's a lot easier to look at, perhaps. Relevant block is not set off by braces. Instead, it's set off by this indentation. So all of these lines are four spaces over to the right, or like about an elephant width. And those are the ones which are going to be executed in this for. If I mess up the indentation on this and I push that print back to the original indentation, that print will leave the for loop. In contrast to C, where here I actually need to move that close brace around. This means that you don't get errors that jump out at you because you put a brace in the wrong place. It does mean that you get errors that jump out at you because you indented a line wrong. So it makes indentation super careful. Hopefully you are being super careful with your indentation anyway, and so this isn't that much more of a burden. But a basic rule for Python, and we'll have a couple of these that we go through through the course of the talk, is try natural syntax before looking anything up. So this syntax for this number in range is very distinctive in terms of style. Lots of things in Python we'll see taking this form. And so if you come up with a new object that you think you should be able to iterate over this in this format, turns out it probably supports that format. We're not going to go super deep into the technical reasons why that's true, but it's a useful intuition to have when you're approaching Python programs that this thing is just going to work. Try it, boot up the command line interpreter, see if it works, move on with things before you even need to open up Google and say, like, what's the syntax for this particular thing. Lots of Python you can discover just by trying. This if is even more similar to C than the fours are. Note that there's no parentheses. The parentheses are, again, harmless but unnecessary. There is a colon at the end, just like the for loops. And again, the relevant blocks are indented rather than set off by braces. This else is at the original level of indentation, and its relevant block is indented again. And those work exactly as they do in C. This is actually very much the same. Again, print loses one character off of printf. You pass in strings. Turns out strings can either be marked off by single quotes or double quotes. There's no difference except that inside of single quotes, you can use double quotes with abandon rather than having to escape all of them. And inside of double quotes, you can use single quotes with abandon without having to escape them. If you want to mix them, you can certainly look up online how to do that. You'll notice that over here, I've passed in end equals this thing. This is an example of an optional argument, which is one of those things that Python supports that makes it quite useful. So like print actually has a lot of arguments, which are usually set to their default value. But here, I've decided to override the one called end. The reason that I have to override it with an empty string is that print in Python by default prints out a new line after the thing that you told it to. So this hash is actually going to print out a hash and a new line. And if I don't want this hash to print out a new line after it, then I have to say don't print one. But yes, so the one last thing that this program is missing that one has is an include at the top. Print is baked into Python so basically that there's no header or module that you need to include. Though if I wanted to include other things in a Python script, I would do it in a very similar format. Words are just slightly different. So I mentioned that we don't need a main here because the Python starts executing at the top. If I wanted to wrap this in a function, I would do it like this. I say def function name. Arguments might go in here, and we'll see some of those later. Colon, and then again, this entire set of block is what is the operational block for that function. So this is the definition of the function, and there's the declaration. Then down here, I can just call the function. And again, the program interpreter, starting at the top, will see, this is the definition. It won't execute this until it gets here. And it's like, oh, now you've called it. I guess I should execute it. A thing that's very common to see in Python files, especially Python files that are released to the public and developed and maintained, is something of this form. This is basically, so because Python, you start at the top, and then you execute down to the bottom, if I just had Mario called out here, then anytime I included this file in another file because I wanted to use this Mario function, that other file would also have this call to Mario in it. And when I ran that file, it would call Mario. So it's possible that I only want to run this if I've actually executed this particular file. And so I can wrap this in an idiom like this, where I say, if the name of this execution environment is main, then I want to do these things. Otherwise, somebody else can include my function, my file, and just get access to these functions without having to run the things that I want to execute in this file. This is, again, optional but very common. These things are exactly the same between C and Python, certainly in 3. I think in 2, the division operator sometimes gave you back floats when you operated on ints. And like either you wanted that or you didn't. But plus, minus, and times work exactly like you'd expect. Except over slightly more types, so you can multiply floats by ints. And those sorts of things, a set works exactly the same. You can use two equal signs and an in equals greater than, less than. These sorts of things have the meanings that you're familiar with them. Where C uses these operators, Python uses slightly more English readable ones. So instead of two ampersands, you literally type the word and, or not, like in your conditional statements. We saw earlier that this syntax in C corresponds to this syntax in Python, and there's not a lot different there except for a little bit of punctuation around the sides. Where C would use else if, Python uses elif, but these are mostly surface level changes. Iteration like this is often written in this idiom in Python. You can manufacture this sort of thing with like a while loop on the outside if you wanted, but you certainly don't have to. And again, if you wanted to print out elements of an array, you might do it this way. One of the fun things about Python, though, is that you don't need to use this paradigm, and you can use a slightly more elegant one. You say for a in array. So rather than going here and running over the indices and then pulling out individual elements, you tell the for to actually just run over the elements themselves. And then whatever you're doing inside can operate directly on the elements, which is pretty fun. And we'll use that idiom again and again as we walk through code. This is, again, an example of something that I'll call Python magic, though there are very technical reasons why it works. And there are technical things that need to be true about array in order for this to work behind the scenes. The thing is that most types, which you'd expect this to work, have had this implemented for you in the built-in language. Another thing that, it would be nice if this worked in every language, but there are some reasons why it can't. Print this string times this number. Turns out in Python, this does exactly what you'd like, which is just fun. And means that we can actually reduce this program, again, Mario.c, rather than iterating a lot, we can just say, I want some number of spaces, I want some number of hashes, and some hashes at the end. And again, we use this format. Here, we're passing in a variable this way. Again, we don't need to say what type of variable it is, and the only time we'll get errors is at runtime. When somebody tries to pass something in, it'll come into the function just fine. If we wedge here, because this isn't a thing that you can create ranges over, I'll get a runtime error there, and I'll have to debug it that way. But in the meantime, I don't have to be very careful about what gets passed in, so long as in the actual execution, it all works very cleanly. I can even make this a little bit cleaner using a particular built-in function on strings called, which is writejustify. This is just a useful function lying around the library. It's in the documentation if you go and look for it. And I say, well, I'm going to have this string. You know, it's some number of hashes. And I'd like to write justify it, pad it out with spaces to be this length. Again, this is in the documentation, which brings us, I'll actually click through these, which brings us to our second rule for Python. Standard library functions and methods are your friends. And it's often worth your while to go looking for, I wonder if there's a thing that just does this. There probably is. If you know you'd like to pad out a string, if you'd like to take the back half of a string, if you'd like to search through a string, if you'd like to smash a couple of things together with a string with commas between them, there are standard library functions for doing this, and it makes your life easier if you use them instead of rolling out everything on your own and, you know, five lines of code here, five lines of code here. That really starts to add up to real time. One of the interesting things about how this gets called, you'll notice that there's a dot thing. I have like some object on the left, and then I called a dot a function. This is one of the paradigms that Python uses for attaching methods to objects. We'll talk about what this is very briefly at the end, but know that we can both operate on things by taking that thing, saying dot whatever, or by calling a function that takes that object and some other arguments. So these are both ways that things get done in Python, and whether a particular functionality is implemented in this style is something that you should look up until you get a hang for which one it's likely to fall into. There's a more or less cohesive philosophy behind Python that you absorb mostly by writing a lot in it. At some point, which one of these something will be implemented as becomes natural. For now, it's just something you learn as you figure out each individual thing. So standard library functions are your friends, and they let you write things that take up this much space really shortly, really elegantly. And this is actually probably more legible, I'd say, than the C program over there. Not to mention the fact that it's so short that you can fit a whole elephant in the space that we've saved. Another thing, this is an implementation of Mario.c, which I think is as short as you can get it. It doesn't have the get int, but it hard codes a value of 10 the same way that this one does. Turns out that this clocks in at 84 characters, whereas Python is 64. And this is infinitely more readable than this garbage here. So Python is more efficient in space. It's slightly less efficient in time, but not by much. Lists are an important thing in Python. We haven't seen them, but they operate much like arrays do in C. So here you can declare them. You can pass them into a thing. Now squares holds an array of these things. Again, we haven't declared its type. But if we ever try to use it, anything that you'd expect to work on an array of integers is going to work on an array of integers. This is a thing which you absolutely can't do in C because the memory management is so hands-on, but is very easy to do in Python. If I want my array to be larger, I can append an element to it, and it's fine. What's going on behind the scenes, the interpreter will go out and get some memory, and maybe it'll get a little bit of extra memory so I don't have to realloc every time. But how much more memory does it need? These aren't decisions that you have to make. These are decisions that the interpreter is going to do. Here we see range can take two arguments, but it's still going to be inclusive of the top, so we add one there, whatever. This is an idiom, which is an even more clever way to write things like this. It's called list comprehension. And here what we're saying is I'd like to put in I squared for every value of I in this range. This thing on the right could be another array. And this thing on the left could be any particular function that would take in I as a variable and give me out some result. What I'm going to do is I'm going to construct an array that's all of these things for each value in this range. And this is super elegant, super short, and it's very clear what it means. This is one of the things, this is again, one of very emblematic of the reasons that people like Python. If you like programming like this, then Python is a language that you might like to learn. And again, there are technical reasons why this works, but as far as we're concerned, we more or less don't care. So if you want to print out lists, some of the same idioms are useful. For I in this range, we could index through all the things and then print them all out. You'll see len here. If you've ever wanted to get the length of the array, that's very easy in Python. It's very hard in C. This would print out exactly what you'd expect it to. We can also, as we've seen before, iterate over the elements in the array directly and then just talk about them rather than having to index back into the array every time. This is a thing that you can do. So in C, if you ask for something like this, print would say, that's an array of integers. That's definitely not a string. I can't print it. Python more or less doesn't care. It's like, is there a way that I could turn this into a string? Yeah, I'll do that. So I'll just print that out. This means that you can do things like this. These are most of the hard parts of Game of 15, written very briefly in Python. You'll see that there's a little bit of, here I've cast an integer to a string, and I have to do that manually if I'm going to add it to another string, or otherwise Python gets confused about whether when you're adding a string to an integer, am I supposed to get an integer back or a string back? But again, if you just call str on a thing, and it could in any possible world be converted into a string, it will probably be converted into a string. Here we see use of nested list comprehension on the left, some indexing, which is exactly as you'd be used to it, and some printing out of things. Again, we've defined some functions, and we'll call them down in main when we actually execute the file. Oh, return works exactly like you'd expect from working with C. Find, we can set up things like this. Here's list comprehension. There's an assignment to a variable. And we can actually do it even easier. We don't need to write search, because built into the language is if this thing is in this array. Return true, else return false. So that's the entirety of find. The entirety of sort involves calling sort, which is, there are implementations of this built into certain C libraries. If you'd like to sort it backwards, you can override this optional argument reverse with a true. And if you'd like to sort over strings, that's built in as well. So this not to say, like, these are things that you need to do every day, but the idea is that this is the philosophy of Python, that all these things which you'd sort of want to do are built in. And most standard functions, so sort, length, whatever, support most logically sensible input. You call len on an array the same way you call len on a string. You sort strings the same way you sort arrays. Most standard functions that people build and most third-party libraries that people build, because they're emulating the design of the standard library, can be called on everything that you're like, why doesn't this just work in C? More or less, it like will work in Python, because people work behind to figure out what a thing is and then operate appropriately on it. So again, technical background, but makes it easy, our lives easier as programmers. So here's file.io. File.io has lots of little things that make it complicated, and so there are resources online. But in a nutshell, you call open on a file name with a particular type. So that's read, read and write or append. You read a certain number of characters out, and you print those, you'll get hello. Assuming that like this file had hello in it. Call to read, and what you'll get back is a string which has all of the rest of the array, or all of the rest of the file. If you call read again, you're at the end of the file, and so you don't get anything, and so you'll close. Again, this is .close rather than close file, as it would be in C. This is more or less because f is a thing, and you'd like for f to close. But basic file.io is not particularly complicated. Again, if you'd like to open a file, you'd like to read a particular line, you can get out a particular line. There's built-ins for that. If you'd like to write a thing, you can write this. If you'd like to write out individual bytes, you can write those. And if you'd like to iterate over the lines of a file individually, as we did in a pset a few weeks ago, you can do that too. Again, most objects that you'd like to be able to iterate over support iterating over them in Python. A file is maybe a thing that I'd like to iterate over line by line. If it was a dictionary of words and I was trying to get those individual words out, then within this loop, line is going to be each word in turn, and this is going to be executed for every line in the file till the end of the file. And again, if I printed out each line, the lines come with new lines, so I'm setting the end back to a thing like this, then I'd get the contents of my file. All right? The second thing, which operates in some ways like lists and in some ways as something substantially more powerful, are dictionaries, which are really cool to use but are basically hash tables in disguise. You create one using exactly two characters, which is awesome. If you like tried to implement a hash table for your problem set, you know how much pain that can be, but like people have done it and done it so well that you don't have to worry about it anymore. Then you can insert individual things. Hash tables or dictionaries don't particularly care what you're storing in them. So if some entries are numbers, if some entries are lists, if some entries are other dictionaries, and some entries are strings, Python doesn't much care. Again, if you like go into it expecting a string and what you get back is an array, that's your problem. Okay, and, like maybe it's the fault of whoever started was putting things in the dictionary. Maybe that was you. If that was someone else, hopefully they were well-behaved about what was going in the dictionary and didn't leave any pitfalls for you to fall into. But the standard functions will give you back well-behaved things. So they say this returns back a dictionary of strings, then everything you're going to get out of it is a string. If you do some of this and it trips you up, well, that might be on you. Python certainly gives you enough rope to hang yourself if you'd like. Now we can print out individual elements of this, and this returns exactly what you'd expect. Exactly what you'd expect, I guess, is a phrase that I'm using a lot, but that's more or less how Python works. If you ask for a thing which isn't in it, Python will throw out an error and will quit you out of whatever program you were in. It'll actually print out more information than that. It'll point you out a line and so. And again, maybe we want to iterate over dictionaries and find all the things in it. Here, we are iterating over two things at the same time, and so we'll do it with a key, comma, value. But then print out all of these. Oh, and if we wanted to cast, if we actually ran this, we would have some trouble because when we went in with David, it couldn't add. If we didn't cast it to a string first, we couldn't add that array of strings onto a string. But if we cast it to a string, then we get something like this, which is maybe what we'd like to read. And this is Speller. We just read in things, so we can read in individual words, them as lines. We chop off the last thing, so colon minus one chops off the last thing that the last character of a string. We'll say, okay, each one of those gets inserted into this dictionary, mapping to a value of one. We don't particularly care about that one, but it's just there to say, like, oh, well, this thing got put in the dictionary, because later what we're going to do is we're going to say, well, if it's in the dictionary at all. Again, this check for membership is operating using a completely different algorithm than it will in a list, but we call it the same way, which is some of that Python sugarcoating things so that they're easier to use. And again, we've seen things like this before. This is basically find, or it's exactly the same syntax as find, but it's operating over a completely different structure, and we don't particularly care. So those are the things that you were asked to implement for Speller. At this rate, we're going to get more or less all of the PSETs done.
So that basically just comes back as incorrectly spelled if it doesn't match something in the dictionary?
Yes. And so this is an adaptation of a problem set which asks you to do exactly that.
Why is the line minus one there?
When you're iterating over a file and asking for it by lines, the lines come with a new line character at the end of it. The minus one is just to chop those off. And this is a particularly flexible way of indexing into things. So if you have a string and you'd like, well, I'm going to start at character three and I'm going to go to the end, three colon will do that for you. If you're like, I want to start at the beginning and go to the last minus one character, colon minus one. And if you wanted to go from the third to the minus first, then you'd say three minus one. Additionally, if you want to index into things counting from the back, you just index in with minus numbers. And because like where C would explode or maybe feed you other memory you didn't have access to, here you can say like minus one means the last but one character in a string. Modules are analogs to libraries in C. And are useful for a lot of things that you'd like to do in Python besides, simple manipulation of variables, you want to hook into larger libraries with larger interfaces and more capabilities for interacting with other parts of the world. Sys is one of those. It's a bunch of tools that are useful for interacting with the system itself, and we'll import it like import sys. There's more documentation from that, which you could go here, or you could find on Google by Googling Python sys. You type in enter. The first link is going to be the documentation in Python 2. The second link is going to be the documentation in Python 3. And if we wrote out a file that looked like this, so if in particular we're looking at operating on command line arguments, like we learned to do very early on in this class, this isn't difficult. You can get out argv, which is one of those things which is implemented by sys. It's not built in to the base package, but again, you can extend it by importing that functionality from sys. You'll call it sys.whatever. Here there's argv. There's actually no argc in sys because you can get it so easily by calling len. If we then printed that out, then we ran in our on our terminal echo args.py, we get back an array which is this first argument. Again, this is argv0, which is the name of the thing that got called. If we called it with additional arguments, we get those back. This is one way of getting command line arguments. If you want flags, where you turn particular things on or override particular defaults, argparse is your friend. And again, you find that online at Python argparse at Google. There are a couple of utility modules that you find yourself using again and again if you spend any time in this language. Importing JSONs for reading in and out of JSON files. Not that complicated. You open up a file. You call json.load on that file, and you get back a thing. What is that thing? It's a JSON object. Where that JSON has array, the Python has arrays. Where that JSON has associative arrays, Python has dictionaries, strings, numbers, and so on. You wanted to dump that out. You open up a new file. You call dump. And loads and dumps to go in and out of strings. Similarly, pickle gets called in basically the same interface. Is slightly more useful if you're dumping Python objects. So if you've ever wanted to save a version of the current status of a variable for a future run of your program, pickle is Python's library for doing that. If you have any sort of variable that can be written out in like words and characters and bytes, like this dictionary we could write down. We could write it down as like a JSON object, which was literally these characters. And then it would be very easy for a human to open up and read it. If we didn't particularly care about humans reading it, we could pack it even more efficiently into forms that could later be unpacked or that could later be inflated. And this saves 80% of the space that your objects might take if you wrote them out longhand. You call pickle very much the same way: dump, load, and then you get your things back. So if you are writing Python very short Python programs that want to save state and then read them back later. Things like this are your friend, that you could very easily dump them as JSON. Most Python objects can dump out to JSON if there's any hope that structurally they could be represented that way. These are just the tip of the iceberg on modules that are useful. So sys, us, multiprocessing are sort of basic workhorses for things. If you need to interact with the file system, os dot, like os dot is file, os dot is directory, os dot make file. These are your friends. If you want to interact with particular file types, JSON, pickle, CSV, if you want to interact with web pages, the URL lib for getting HTTP pages, BS4, beautiful soup. It's a wonderful parser for HTML. You run on HTML, and you get this nested array object, which you can traverse over, look in with like just looking for if is in, which is fantastic. There's a bunch of packages for running for doing particularly mathy things. So if you want to multiply, invert, transform matrices, NumPy is used by people all over the world for that. SciPy is even more useful tools in that direction. Sklearn, machine learning, natural language processing, super useful stuff, gets implemented in Python all the time. And again, takes slightly longer to write. Takes slightly longer to run, but the reason that real engineers tend to use Python is because you tend to be blocked on you writing the code rather than your computer running the code. So if you were going to write a program which lots of other people were going to use forever, like Linux, you might write it in C. If you were going to write a computation engine, you might write it in Python if you needed to change it every couple of months. Some people would write it in C because they're like that. So we've seen import sys as a way of getting things, of getting module into your program. You can also import it as a nickname if you'd like. Again, multiprocessing is a pain to type out every time, so import as MP, and then anytime you use it in the program, you'll say MP.process or what have you. If you'd like to import only a single thing, so URL lib has a thing called request, so you can just import that. Later on, you won't invoke it as urllib.request, but just as request by itself. And you can import everything from a module if you'd like. This is occasionally not a good idea. This is usually not a good idea, actually, because if anything in that module has a name that you wanted to use somewhere else in your program, you can't. And it is not always obvious that that's the case. In order to like make sure that what you were doing was safe, you need to open up the module and see all of the names that end up in there, all of the functions, all of the variables that live in that module, because you're bringing all of them into your local namespace. So people do this. It is generally recommended that you don't do this, but people do this all the time because they're lazy and don't want to type out mp.anything ever. All this talk about modules brings me around to a short talk on how you design programs in Python. The first step is to check to see if anyone else has already done the thing or done 90% of the thing. Chances are they probably have, and you should go get their thing and run that, or write a wrapper around it to adapt it to your purpose. It's only after that has failed that you then go on and begin thinking about how you would put this thing together. There's lots of stuff out there, and that's one of the most useful things about Python. Like, the language is elegant, the language is easy to use, but also, because it's so elegant and easy to use, people have been using it for a long time, and there's a lot of stuff out there that you can harness for your own use. So, last rule of Python is somebody else has already probably written a module for that. Somebody else has already probably written a library for that. Before you try to do a thing, look to see if it's been implemented. It's not that hard. All of the modules that I put up before, with perhaps one exception, come pre-installed in every standard Python installation. And so with a call to import whatever, you have all of that functionality at your fingertips. Beginning to wrap up this talk, there are a few things that I've left as black boxes and sort of glossed over, and there's a few white lies that I've told that for the sake of honesty, I'll at least point at here, even if I won't go super deep into all of them and their technical explanations. A lot of the things that I've called magic is what other people would call object-oriented programming. So there are lots of things. So variables are very often not simple bytes sitting in memory, but are very complicated objects that have internal state about functions and lots of hidden variables, lots of hidden functionality, which lets you turn them into strings, which lets you iterate over them. And if you're writing, and the reason that they have all of this rich functionality is because the architects of the language, have gone through and for every standard object, put in the functionality to say, this is how this is going to operate if someone wants to iterate over it. So everything that somebody might possibly want to iterate over has logic written in manually on how you're supposed to iterate over that object. Everything that you might possibly want to dump into a string has logic written. This is the function that you call if you want to dump this out to a string. This is why you can call len on things. This is why you can call for in. This is why you can call if in. On everything that you'd want to, because those all are carrying with them the technical know-how to do that. This is something that I am super not going to go into, but for thing in list is subtly different from C-style for loops, and you can read all about that on the internet if you're interested. There is a dark side to all of this that I mentioned, so there's two things. The first is that this object-oriented programming adds a lot of overhead to random things, so you end up using a lot more memory, you end up using a little more time than you would otherwise. But the more insidious dark side to this is if things just act like you want them to without you having to think super hard about whether this should be an int or whether this should be a float, it might be that over here you produce an int, but over here you think, it might be that over here you produce a float, when you get to the second part of your program, you're thinking, but they'll always pass me an int. And if they don't, it's possible that you wedge somewhere if you try to use that to index into an array or what have you. So one of the really useful things about C is it forces you to think really hard before you make any, before you bring any variable into existence. Like, what is the type of this variable? And it's going to have that type for all time. This is not true of Python. And in fact, you can, if you're just sort of going by ear, and you make some decisions one way in one place and some decisions one way in the other place without putting enough stuff behind the scenes in the other place to like catch things properly, you can get some very strange errors. And the program can keep running for a very long time because it's doing a lot of work to say, well, this thing could operate this way, so I'm going to run that way. And in fact, the fact that it takes the fact that it pushes forward through a lot of small errors means that often when an error is actually bad and you do actually want to fix it, it ends up miles away. The program ends up stopping miles away from when you had your error. And so one thing that we would like programs to do when we're debugging is fail loudly and fail very quickly when something goes wrong. Python is very bad at that. Python is very good at not failing and rolling forward through unexpected things. So this is useful for when you're writing small programs. When you get complicated bugs, it sometimes takes a long time to tease them out. So there's a dark side to all of this, like, it just works. It just works like you'd expect it to. Except that when it doesn't, you end up in a completely different place and trying to figure out where it was that you went wrong. Garbage collection is, so one thing that you will notice is that any of these things that I brought into existence, these arrays, these dictionaries, these objects, these files, never get freed. There was no call to free in any of this talk, and that was on the C side because we never got into those things. But in Python side, there isn't a free. Things get automatically freed when Python thinks you're not looking at them. It's really good at not freeing things that you might still possibly be looking at. But this means that if you were going to allocate this big thing, and you're like, oh, I'm done with it now, it's difficult to tell Python that you're done with it now. You can sometimes set that variable to be none and then hope that eventually the garbage collector comes through and cleans it out. But again, you don't have control over that. And one of the reasons that people use C for really performance critical things is this ability to really know when memory is allocated and when it's freed and have a lot of control over saying, I'm using no more memory than I need, which is something that Python is not that great at.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. Oh, so if something's going wrong and you're in debugging mode, you would very often want your program to like tell you where exactly it's gone wrong and not just like quietly stop running, but you'd actually like it to like print out all sorts of information about like here was this, this thing happened. If you're like printing a if you're running a web server. Yeah. If you're running a web server, it's sometimes bad if you're always discarding errors and just saying, well, that didn't work, I'm going to stop, I'm just going to ignore it and keep going on, because then you can get in hundreds of these errors and not see them. It would certainly be useful for debugging purposes if every time your web server made an error, you like had durable records of that. Maybe you even want the program to stop so that those records don't get buried under things. But again, that's in debugging mode. Often in production mode, it's the world is a little different. And in like tiny scripts that I'm running, where the thing that I said to do might be only a little bit off from what I would like it to do, then sort of pushing through errors is something you might want. And in those cases, certainly Python really earns its stars. The last thing that I didn't talk in this that I didn't talk about, but can be really infuriating the first time you have one of these errors, and the second and third and fourth time you have one of these errors. Python, I mentioned that it uses whitespace to tell you what level of indentation, what functional block you're in. It treats tabs and spaces differently. So if you tab over four, and then the next line has four spaces, even if they show up in the same as the same amount in your editor, Python doesn't treat them the same. In fact, Python treats tabs and spaces like oil and water. They are just different things. There is no particular length that a tab is, so it's not like a tab equals eight spaces, and so you could get around it that way. Like, when it says, OK, what level of white space I'm at, it's actually looking for a pattern of spaces and tabs. And so the best way to deal with this is always use spaces all the time. And in fact, in the Cloud9 IDE and the CS50 IDE, your tab key inserts four spaces in instead of a tab, which is super useful. Though again, if you wrote a Python program with tabs, that would be fine. It's just if somebody went in and tried to add a single line to your program that had, you know, four spaces for every tab, it would break. And it would break in a way that really isn't visible. Though the actual error message that it throws has to do with like new indent not expected here. Or if it's talking about indents and it looks like it's wrong, it's probably because there's a tab space problem. They're still infuriating to debug. And the biggest hole in this talk, which I didn't get to because it's really a complicated, subtle topic, and it's not wasn't necessary to do any of the things we've done so far, are a concept called tuples. They are very much like arrays that you can't modify. They get used all over the place because they are useful for lots of things that arrays are not useful for. But if you'd like to make an array and then promise the interpreter that you are never going to want to modify that thing, in fact, if you want to modify it, you'll just make a new one with the new values in it. Those are tuples. Rather than producing them with square brackets, you produce them with round brackets. Why you would use these things is a little bit of a question. The only thing that I'll say about that is you can use tuples as indices for dictionaries. You can't use arrays as indices for dictionaries. And why is, again, technical, and I'm not going to run into it. The pset that I haven't touched on in this talk is pset 6. So here's how you'd implement pset 6 in Python, keeping in mind the Python design cycle. The first thing that you do when you're writing programs is check to see if somebody's done it already. So in fact, if you want to serve Apache 50, it does approximately this, except that it doesn't come standard installed on Linux machines. Python does, and the Python simple HTTP server does as well. If you're ever on a Linux machine or the Cloud9 IDE outside of CS50, and you'd like to serve this current directory to a particular port, Python-m simple HTTP server port. Serves that. You can also import the simple HTTP server, and it's got a lot of functionality if you want to customize it or change it or run it, harness it to run your own server services. So that's Python in a nutshell. And this has been CS50. Thank you.